welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples for improving the overall health of humanity. Remember to check out all of our shows and podcasts at underaffiliated.com. Stream us live every Thursday on Asheville FM from the site or the app. Today, we're talking with Anna Zivskaya. Do I have that right?
Yep.
Excellent. And Crystal Sheriff. And they are from the Asheville-Buncombe County Land Trust. What's really interesting about them is they're going to help us understand different options for obtaining and providing affordable housing in Asheville. Affordable housing is something that there's not lots of here. And so we invited Crystal and Anna in to talk about how they're helping to solve that problem. Crystal, Anna, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Why don't one of you just start and tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the Land Trust?
Sure, I'll start. So I'm Anna Zievska. I'm the executive director of the Asheville-Buncombe Community Land Trust, and we're still a relatively new organization. I was the first hire of the organization about a month and a half before COVID hit, so it was a really interesting time to start a new organization in a new town, and Crystal came on later that year. So now we're up to four staff. We have doubled our size in the past couple of months, and we're really excited about continuing to do the work and creating more permanently affordable home ownership opportunities.
Yeah, and I'm Crystal Sheriff. I am the Community Relations Manager here at Asheville-Buncombe Community Land Trust. And like Anna said, we have expanded our footprint, and so we are just figuring that out as we continue to fight for affordable home ownership and for folks to be able to stay in Asheville.
Tell us a little bit about what a land trust does.
Yeah, so the way that the model works is we separate the ownership of the land from the ownership of the structure on that land. We are right now primarily focusing on home ownership opportunities and usually for right now, again, single family home ownership opportunities. Although we will get into rentals, we will get into duplexes, townhomes, condos, even commercial spaces in the near future. But again, right now we're just focused on single family home ownership opportunities. And so, again, the way that the model works is we separate the ownership of the land from the ownership of the structure on that land or the home on that land. When we sell the home, we're not selling the land to the buyer. What we do is we enter into a ground lease agreement, and that ground lease agreement is 99 years. At the end of those 99 years, it's renewable for another 99, so on and so forth. So what that ground lease tool does is create permanent affordability to ensure that future income qualified buyers will be able to afford that same house. So there is some appreciation in the home. The current owner does grow equity at a rate of 2.25% compounded annually, but that is capped, again, to make sure that the future buyers will be able to afford that same home. As we know, prices skyrocket. We've seen it happen here just in the past couple of years, but especially over the past couple of decades. And so what we want to do is to make sure that in the next few years, in the next few decades, we are preserving those affordable opportunities for people instead of pushing people out and people being priced out and not being able to come back to their neighborhoods.
So how does the Land Trust keep folks from getting land and then flipping it? Because that's what kind of the big issue is. People buy a condo or a house or whatever and they want to resell it, and that's what drives up the price. It's kind of speculative. How does a Land Trust or does a Land Trust limit that?
Yeah, so we will never sell our land. We actually can't sell land without our entire membership voting to approve the sale of that land. So, you know, within our portfolio internally, we are going to make sure that the land does not get sold and there are those future restrictions on the land. And while we can't prevent what happens on the open market, of course, what we can do is acquire as much land and as many properties as possible to balance out that market increase in price.
How do you acquire the land? How do you identify it? And how do you make it part of the you put the house on it and all of that?
So there are limited opportunities, like you said, but we have been fortunate to acquire a few parcels of land and homes as well. A couple of those we purchased on the open market. We so far have purchased two existing homes that were on the open market, and we're actually under contract on a third existing home right now that, again, was on the open market. And you know, we just told the sellers and their agent our mission, what we do, what we're all about, and it was really creating that relationship and that partnership with the sellers. It takes a seller that is, you know, interested in maintaining affordability and our mission to work with us. And again, we've been fortunate to have some of those opportunities and work with the sellers to be able to purchase the home for a price that's in our budget. In addition to that, we've had some sellers who have done what's called a bargain sale, and that means that they have sold the land or the home for less than appraised value, and then they were able to write off that difference between appraised value and sales price on their taxes. So we've had some of that. Then we have to get creative, right? So there's some land that we're going to be purchasing from the city for a dollar a lot. So that's going to be a tremendous help. And just working with owners who have not listed their properties on the open market, we really welcome people to contact us if they're interested in selling their property, so that we can have a conversation about it.
That's our first opportunity to ask you to provide your contact information if people who are listening are interested in finding out more.
Sure. Yeah, they can email me directly at anna@abclt.org. That's anna@abclt.org. Our website is abclt.org. And so people can go on there and look at our donate page and see how they can get involved.
How does your work, where it's, you know, sounds a little bit like property by property, how does it all work to improve the overall affordability of housing?
Yeah, so it's a slow process. Again, we're a new organization, and it takes time to build our portfolio. What I can say is that there are community land trusts all across the country. There are some of the oldest ones are right here in North Carolina. We look at Chapel Hill. We look at Durham a lot. They're over 30 years old, and they have over 300 properties in their portfolio. And so that's our goal, right, to get to that hundreds of properties in our portfolio to make sure that there are plenty of opportunities in Asheville and Buncombe County that are affordable. But right now, we are really just reliant on the people in the community to support us, to become members of our organization, to donate to us, to talk to us about what opportunities they have as far as land, as far as housing, what they can donate, what they can help us with. A lot of our professional services are donated to us. So real estate agents, attorneys, real estate attorneys are doing the work pro bono so that we can save thousands of dollars on those transactions.
So what's the process for evaluating and looking at a property? Like, how does it become available? Is it a competitive market for you? I'm just trying to understand how you identify available properties and get into the process of acquiring it.
Or disallowing something and saying, well, this isn't going to fit for us.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Right. Yeah. So we work in the historically black neighborhoods in the city of Asheville. That's our primary focus area. We serve all of Buncombe County, but again, primarily we're in the historically black neighborhoods in the city of Asheville. So to date, all the properties that we have acquired have been in those neighborhoods. I specifically watch the MLS listings in those neighborhoods. We typically look for homes that are around 300,000. I would say under 300,000, but that's not really an option right now. So, you know, in that 275 to 325 price range is kind of our sweet spot and what we look for on the market. And there are not many options. So it's not like I have to sift through a whole bunch of listings every day. It's really just kind of once in a blue moon that something comes on the market in our price range in those neighborhoods. And another important aspect is that we look to have an income qualified buyer who has gotten pre-qualified with the bank when we go to make an offer on a home so that we can turn around and sell it to that buyer pretty quickly.
So how did you guys get involved in this?
A community land trust, especially Asheville's community land trust, is just what it sounds like. It's super community built, super grassroots. And really, it all came together because of local folks who saw a need. At one point, the South Side River Arts District, as a lot of people know it, was the fastest gentrifying neighborhood in the entire country. So when you start having statistics and little facts come out in a tiny place with like 100,000 people, I think it really starts to get folks' attention. And really, that is how we came about. By folks in the community wanting to be able to keep people in the community and seeing Asheville change in such a rapid rate and thinking, what's the one thing we don't have here? What's something that could be a more innovative solution? And that's how you got a community land trust. Prior to working with ABCLT, I didn't have as much background in housing. I did work with the YWCA and some similar kind of concepts definitely overlap. But in terms of actually housing, this was definitely the first time that I had taken it on. Definitely my first time hearing about a community land trust, which was super super interesting, just in the way that the model works. I had never heard anything like that. And I think when you're dealing with a population who is so used to being locked out of opportunities, especially as it pertains to land, I think we have a little bit more work that we have to do when it comes to explaining the model and how it works and how it's still beneficial. Because the one thing that we all know is that land is finite, right? And so we're all like trying to land grab all the time. And that's the way things have been since the beginning of colonization. It's like land grabbing. This is the only thing we can have. This is the only thing that proves that we have something. And so getting into the concept of the land being in community ownership is a bit revolutionary, and I think it takes time to fully explain why it looks the way it does and also the benefits that, you know, our buyers are still able to have.
So I have been in the nonprofit world for about 10 years now. I have always kind of had a passion and a focus on real estate. I was actually born and raised in the Ukraine, and my parents and I came over here as refugees when I was 9. They spent about 10 years waiting to hear back after they applied to come here. And once we came here, we were supported by a nonprofit who basically set us up in an apartment for and paid our rent for a month until my parents had to find jobs and be able to pay the rent going forward. But, you know, that really instilled a sense of importance of housing and stability in me. And so that has really kind of fueled my passion for this work. And when I, after grad school, I spent a lot of time in Charlotte. When I was working there, I was working in the community directly with residents. So a lot of grassroots organizing, a lot of grassroots community development, and really just heard a lot of the same stories over and over again about how important stability is, how important home ownership is, how important wealth is. And we're not just talking about individual wealth, but we're talking about community wealth too, because you know, anywhere you go where cities have experienced urban renewal, it's the same story. There were thriving neighborhoods. We're talking about historically Black neighborhoods. They were thriving. They had everything that they needed in that community. And then it all fell apart. It was taken away from them. So the stories, again, are the same. You hear people talking about wanting that back, wanting that fabric of community back, wanting those resources back, just wanting, you know, basic needs in the community, things that everybody in the city wants, despite of, you know, income and race and other demographics. And so that is always in the front of my mind when we're doing this work, is to make sure that we are listening to the community and serving the community to make sure that we can create opportunities that people, again, used to have. It's not like this is a foreign concept.
How is this funded? Whether it's your organization or the houses, what's the financial model?
Right. So our funding primarily is from the city of Asheville. We received $1 million from the bond referendum a few years ago. And we, per our agreement with the city, we're creating 8 home ownership units within city limits using that funding. Our funding for operating expenses has not been as easy to come by. So we're actually about to launch a fundraising campaign to make sure that we as an organization are able to sustain and continue operating, continue paying our staff and doing the great work that we're doing. But we were really fortunate to receive that $1 million from the city. Not every community land trust has that. A lot of community land trusts struggle to get off the ground. And so that really is what I call our seed funding, was able to propel us to start acquiring properties pretty quickly into the beginning of our journey here.
I'll just say $1 million for 8 homes is extraordinary when you just divide that out, and how low that seems, especially in a place where, you know, houses are easily almost to $500,000. So That, right. That would be two houses, maybe, in the open market.
Yeah. And so what we do is when we sell the house, of course, we get proceeds from that sale. And so we're able to recycle those funds. What I should probably add is that since we received the $1 million, prices have gone up significantly. And so we've actually had to raise additional funds to be able to create those 8 units. And we have received $125,000 from Dogwood Health Trust as well to be able to offset that gap, that increase in housing costs since the bond referendum.
You mentioned just now that you can use the sale of the proceeds of the house. Does the homeowner get, if they sell the house over, let's say they live in there to 10 years, 15 years, do they get some of the proceeds as well?
Yes. So I always like to use the example of $150,000. So if somebody buys a house from us for $150,000 and they stay in that home for about 10 years, they actually accumulate almost $40,000 in equity. So we take that $150,000 original sales price, add the $40,000, and that is the new sales price. So that $190,000 is what that owner will sell the home for. It will get sold to another income qualified buyer for that amount. And so we're not having to invest any additional dollars in that home to keep it affordable. And the buyer gets to walk away with that equity.
What's the incentive for the homeowner to maintain the condition of the property? Because typically that's one of the things that drives, you keep your property in shape so that you can sell it for a better price. And if you don't keep it in shape, if you're still going to get the same price, what are there any incentives around that or any requirements for maintenance of the home?
Yeah, so they do get a better price, if you will, right? So they are accumulating that equity. So if they purchase it from us for $150,000 and they stay in the home for 10 years, they can sell it for $190,000 or so in the future. So there's that growth, but it's limited. You're right. It's not the same as on the open market. And what we do is we have a vested interest in the maintenance of the home because we own the land and we want to see the resale value stay. So what we do is we just check in with the owners annually, at least, to make sure that everything is going well. We also have a repair and reserve fund for each home that we sell. So every month, the owner is putting money aside into that repair reserve fund. And again, that's to make sure that if there are repairs needed in the future, they can pull money from that account to be able to do those repairs.
What you also help provide is stability. And you provide basic needs, or housing provides basic needs for folks, and it provides for community ownership and community building. A lot of what you focus on is in black neighborhoods, and the gentrification pushed people out and trying to rekindle that vibrancy and that sense of community. Tell us a little bit about what the gap is right now and how you're helping to provide those things and what some of the challenges are to building back a community.
Just as you said that and I heard the word gap, the first thing I thought of was food deserts. A lot of where the black community in Asheville lives, food deserts are, they kind of align with food deserts. And if we know what a food desert is, it's essentially being further than a mile and a half away from fresh produce. So not just Lay's potato chips and, you know, Juicy's or Huggies or whatever, like being able to purchase kale, chicken, you know, normal things that would make a well-balanced meal. And so a lot of these communities that Anna was previously speaking about had those grocery stores at every corner. So that's one thing. I would say another gap is just folks having the resources to build back up communities. I think once you see, like we said, so much of wealth is tied into homes and where you live. And once you see so much of that dwindle, people are kind of forced to pick up the pieces. And so with that, a lot of times those gaps look like just a lack of resources because there's a lack of wealth happening.
Yeah, and something else that I would add specifically to what we're doing is we're focusing a lot on Housing Authority residents that have vouchers, right? And so if we go back and talk about the history of urban renewal and the history of redlining, you can see that there's a direct correlation between the Housing Authority units that were built and the homes that were taken away during urban renewal. And what people were told a lot of the time is that this would be temporary, that they would be relocated and then they would have opportunities to come back to their neighborhoods or an opportunity to purchase a home somewhere else. And what ended up happening is most people actually stayed in the Housing Authority units permanently, effectively. So we have a big focus on reaching those individuals that have vouchers from the Housing Authority, because we are able to use their vouchers towards purchasing a home. And that has been a really fantastic tool for us to be able to reach lower, much lower incomes than we would be able to without that voucher. So again, that's one of those things that, you know, happened during urban renewal. And we as an organization were formed to address the injustices of urban renewal in the city of Asheville. And that is one of the key focus areas that we have as an organization.
I just want to ground us in what the historically black neighborhoods are in Asheville. So West Asheville, where we currently are right now, the Burton Street community is a historically black neighborhood. Stumptown, which a lot of people don't know, they just think of as Momford, but Momford, where Alday Darling is, and kind of all the way back there where the Momford Park Players amphitheater is, all of that is a historically black neighborhood as well. Southside, where the River Arts District is a historically black neighborhood. Easton, where McCormick Field is, Martin Luther King area, the block, a lot of folks know it as that. That is a historically black area in Shiloh. And I think it's just important to ground where those areas are, because a lot of folks, A, if you just move to Asheville, you may not see Momford as a historically black area. That might be a completely foreign concept. I think if you move to Asheville in maybe next year, Burton Street might not look like a historically black neighborhood. And because of the population of black folks specifically is dwindling so quickly in Asheville, there's also not the population to represent that neighborhood. So just wanted to ground us in where we're talking about, where these target neighborhoods are.
I think that's really important to know, because it's a larger scale than people might realize, especially in Asheville. And I suspect that it's larger scale in a lot of cities. And the issue with that is that no one sees it happening. The displacement is almost silent, except for the people who are experiencing it, which kind of makes it rather insidious. And one of the questions I have, though, is how do you fit in with such a big challenge? Because you're talking about things like the need for rebuilding a community. You're not talking multiple big housing units. You're talking almost house by house. You talked about food deserts. You're one piece of the puzzle, a very important piece of the puzzle, because housing is where it all begins. If you don't have a house, your life becomes very difficult. So how do you fit in with overall community building?
You know, I think it's we're here for the long haul. And I think we have to continue reminding ourselves that we're not here for that instant gratification. We're not here to solve the issue overnight. And we have to know that to make sure that we can continue doing this into the future, because burnout is a real thing in nonprofit work, and especially in this work. You know, I remember we were at a conference last week and hearing all these great presentations talking about statistics and house prices and, you know, what it's going to take to solve this crisis. And it can be really depressing. So you have to keep yourself grounded.
Maybe share a little bit about what you heard and why it feels like it's depressing, because not everybody knows. Not, you know, when you're in the middle of something,
yeah,
you feel the pain, you feel the urgency. But when you're not, and you're just kind of, oh, I agree, there's an affordable housing crisis, provide some details about why it's so frustrating.
Yeah, so the average home sales prices in Buncombe County are over $500,000 now. That number keeps growing and growing.
So how many bedrooms? Like, what's an average size?
Two-bedroom bungalow in West Asheville is probably going to run you up just about $500,000.
Two bedrooms. So that's not a family.
Right.
No, that's somebody that just moved here from Seattle with their dog. And they're going to fix it up. And I bet you that house is going to be 532. And like, no, some of our largest supporters are those people, which is an interesting kind of intersection that I think we just have to realize that's our truth here in Asheville.
Well, so I'm going to give folks a little preview. We're having someone from YIMBY come, which is Yes in My Backyard, because a little bit of what I hear when I hear this conversation about folks, and we'll use the example, someone comes from Seattle and it's a higher cost of living, so they've got a little extra money so they can buy something. And they're philosophically aligned,
mm-hmm.
but their pocketbook is displacement oriented, which they may not mean to do, but that's what happens. So tell folks a little bit about that. It's kind of what you're alluding to, is that money flows in, but does it continue to displace people?
Absolutely. It's one of those concepts of, I think Asheville is very attractive, right? So there's a lot of reasons that folks want to move here. And I think culturally, the culture of Asheville is a large draw. It's liberal-minded. It's a climate haven, if you're tapped into that whole kind of conversation. It's extremely liberal, four seasons. I mean, the whole thing. And so when people decide that they want to move here for a culture, a lot of times the culture that they're moving here, they disrupt because they're bringing a different living wage here, especially now with the rise of working from home. If you bring a different living wage, and folks who have been working in nonprofits or workforce industry in general, which was a large percentage of what we heard about at this conference that Anna mentioned, is that the workforce population is unable to live here. And when we think of that, we're not just talking about servers downtown. We're also talking about firefighters. We're talking about policemen. We're talking about nurses. So these people that we need to be in inner city are unable to compete with wages from someone from San Francisco or Seattle who, to be fair, their housing cost over there, over $1 million. So you see $532,000, you're like, whoa, this is a steal. I'm going to go buy a house in this very cute little quaint area, right? And, you move here and Asheville does a really good job of hiding what they don't want people to see. So you don't even see anybody that you're displacing in, to begin with. Like you said, it's a very insidious kind of situation, which is so interesting because when you look statistically at Montfort, the percentages of Montfort looked very different in the 2010s.
So 15 years or so.
15 years or so, Montfort was 49% black. That is not a fact right now. And so you see how fast that works, but also how insidious it is. And I don't think that population is as aware, because as I said, Asheville does a really good job of who it markets to and what you see when you come here. But that population is here and that population is hurting. And it's not just the black community in Asheville. It's a lot of our workforce. It's a lot of the folks that push the tourism industry. And so that's something to keep in mind as you disrupt any ecosystem, you should really think about what that means. You go into the forest, we're cognizant of this is an ecosystem. Let's not litter. Let's, not feed certain animals that we're not supposed to. And I think you have to have that same mindset when you go into a city.
So just for context, in Montfort, were the people displaced in single family homes? It's helpful sometimes to have a picture of the person and their family and where they lived and how they were displaced. Because a lot of times if you live in a big city and you think about gentrification, you think about urban dwelling and you think about apartments and you think about, oh, I can turn this apartment into condos. Tell us a little bit about the background of Montfort or something so people can understand what it was and what it's become.
So it was a mixture, multifamily homes and single family homes. And well, there's like a whole history to Montfort, but essentially that land, Stumptown is what we're talking about specifically. Tracing back to the late 1880s, that land was essentially given to an enslaved woman upon being freed by her past enslaver. It was about an acre. That acre over time, just for the sake of time, that acre grew over time and more folks came to live there and to settle on that land and created kind of a symbiotic relationship with what we all actually know as like the historic Montfort, which was a white area. So behind All Day Darling and where the amphitheater is and Montfort kind of had this symbiotic relationship of like a lot of those folks were the home caretakers and whatnot for the Montfort area. Over time, more and more black people began to move there, and Montfort as a whole just got really black. And the city, so Asheville actually has one of the largest, the longest running urban renewal programs, not programs, but urban renewal projects, lasted until about the 90s, actually, and then kind of revamped. But around the 80s, you started to see the conversation around Montfort shifting, and there was a lot of little things too. There was also like a punk house there in that neighborhood, and a lot of these little things were kind of put out and pushed down, and then they changed it to the historic neighborhood of Montfort, and that always changes kind of the fabric of any community. And so from there, you just started to see it become more and more. And the thing about Stumptown specifically is that it was able to retain a lot of its black population. I moved to Asheville in 2002. So I was 9. My family came here after 9/11. And I remember Montfort being just, I mean, or the Stumptown area specifically being extremely black. And I never really thought anything of it, but I just knew there was a ton of black people that lived there. And slowly but surely, that was just something that began to change as Asheville created, you know, the historic neighborhood and touted it as this extremely attractive community that's super close to downtown, the walkability. You saw different restaurants come in, you know, 9 Mile is there. That's kind of been longstanding. And just like this, the bed and breakfasts, the slight change into the community is kind of what you see happen in Montfort, to the point where I don't think anyone here associates Montfort with a black community, right? I mean, I don't think so. Most people don't.
Right. And I think that happens in a lot of places. It is a very slow, I shouldn't say very, it's a process that just kind of occurs over time and no one really...
It's strategic.
Is there a degree of intent to have this happen? And the reason there'd be intent is because there's money in those hills, right? There's money in nice houses. There's money in nice restaurants. Is that what's been going on in terms of making housing unaffordable?
I would say so. I wouldn't even say as a city. I think as a like culture, Western culture, we are far more concerned with dollar amounts than we are community, and especially whose community. I don't think all communities are endangered, but I think communities that are undervalued typically are.
Let's connect the dots for a second. When we have this process where we value land, and we value being able to sell to the highest bidder and make money, someone doesn't win from that. And historically, it's been black communities. That's what happened here. So let's just say this is what it is. How do we build that back? How do we use housing as a tool to rebuild those communities that were taken away?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that we have to do is change the way we think about real estate. And that is really what this model is meant to do. We are not here to make a profit off of the homes that we sell. We actually lose money on every sale. And so we have to fundraise to meet that gap that we have when we sell every home and have a loss effectively. So yes, first we have to change how we think about real estate. We have to recognize what it's doing to our communities, and we have to be community minded in what we do and how we purchase properties and how we sell properties and how we show up in community and how we support others in community. The other thing that is really important, especially for people who are just now moving here, but really all across the board, because people who have lived here, a lot of people who have lived here also don't know the history. And so we really encourage everyone to learn the history of the city and especially the neighborhood that they're moving into. So again, the Burton Streets, the East Ends, the Montfords of Asheville. We want people moving to those areas to know what the history of that neighborhood is, who used to live there, what happened. Not ignore that history, not gloss over it and pretend like it didn't happen and everything is fine now, but really recognize what the trauma in those communities is and be part of the solution to heal that trauma.
I think people are living that trauma now. When you talk about food deserts and changing neighborhoods, schools deteriorating, and food deserts aren't too far behind. If you were to talk to someone, how would you describe, and they were to give you money, and they were to say, look, I believe in your cause, and I will give you a significant amount of funding, how would you say you would use it?
So right now we are looking for dollars to continue supporting our operating expenses. And that's not something that, you know, donors like to hear, but that's the reality of it, because we have funds to be able to acquire properties and build properties, renovate properties, and be able to put people into homes. But we can't do that work without having staff, right? Like, those homes don't just magically appear. The buyers don't magically appear and get paired with a home. We have to have people to do the work. And so,
what do they do if someone who's interested is going to balk at giving operating funds? What would you say that person's going to do? You mentioned a couple, but what kind of things would someone
absolutely.
Do?
So we have staff that go out and look at properties, right? So we have to keep an eye out on the market and see what's out there, work with partners, create opportunities for partnering with government, with other nonprofits, with for-profits. So that takes a lot of time and energy to create those relationships, get to know people. And as Crystal said, you know, to educate people on our model, this isn't an easy model to understand. And so it takes a lot of time to be able to educate the community about how this works. We have staff who oversee those acquisitions of properties and any renovations of properties that need to happen. We have staff who screen our applicants. You know, we go out into the community, we recruit applicants, we do marketing, we do orientations for people who are interested in learning about our process. And so, again, that all takes staff time. We have staff who process applications and work with those applicants to make sure that they are ready for pre-qualification. So the way that we work is we have lenders who provide mortgages to our buyers, and we have to get our buyers ready to go to the lender and get pre-qualified. We don't want to send somebody to the lender who's not ready. So that takes time and effort and coordination. After somebody's pre-qualified, then we're working with them to figure out what home they're interested in, what price point they can afford, things like that.
So you're not just looking for people to come and answer phones or help with the filing. These are all relatively skilled positions that you need to keep filled.
Yeah, yeah. And we're fortunate on our staff to have a few people who have roots in the community. And so those relationships are really important to make sure that we are having conversations with people who they trust.
So if someone was really behind this idea, how could they plug in with your organization and say, I want to invest?
Yeah.
How could they plug in, and what would you look for?
Yeah, so they can contact us. They can contact me. My email is anna@abclt.org. That's anna@abclt.org. We have more information on our website, abclt.org/donate, around what kinds of donations we will take. Of course, monetary donations are always welcome, but that donation of land, structures, things like that, we will talk with the potential donor about that situation. Really, we encourage donations of $500 or more, but we know that not everybody can do that. And if you can't donate $500 or more, then donate what you can. Our membership fee is $25 a year. Again, we're a membership-based organization, so our members vote on certain things that happen within the organization, and we encourage everyone to be a member, whether you want to be a voting member or not. It's only $25 a year.
How many members do you have?
Our goal for this year is to get to 200. We are, I think, over halfway there. I think we have about 132 or something like that.
For $25 a year, it's really... I would almost think that's a no-brainer for people to kind of sign up and just say, I support this even in a very small way.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's part of the community aspect of all of this. We want to have as many members as possible so that as many community folks are involved in the work.
I have another question. So I don't know that it was a woman, but the person who came from Seattle and with the dog.
It was definitely a guy.
You remember.
This is all made up, right, by the way.
Yeah. But what might somebody in that situation, what might they do to participate? You know, somebody who might not have that bigger chunk of cash, but says, you know, I probably displaced somebody. What could I do?
I think membership is a really great place to start. I think there are folks who give on a monthly basis. It's a small amount, but it definitely shows that this person's community minded, and every little bit helps, especially when you have operation fees to cover. Also volunteer opportunities. And also, we're a new organization, as Anna mentioned earlier. And so advocacy goes a long way for us, plugging us into the community, into everyone's personal networks. I think a lot of our legwork, of course, is, you know, acquiring homes, but also getting our name out there and really becoming kind of a household name within the community. So
what kinds of things do you do to outreach to the community?
Outreach is
not high priority.
It is high. It's huge. Okay. No, it truly. That's my job. A large thing that we do is partnering with other organizations who have a longstanding relationship with the community. Especially in, well, we have a fund here, Burton Streets, we have two funds, the Burton Street Community Fund and the Montfort and Stumptown Fund. Any funds that we raise in partnership with anyone stays in that fund, and that money is only spent in that neighborhood and can go to a plethora of things like acquiring homes, property tax relief, home repairs. And so outreach a lot of times looks like partnering with businesses in those, you know, two neighborhoods to raise awareness, to raise funds, to put on events. Drop of Sun is a good friend of ours. We did an event with them, Garden Party, Harvest Records, and Momford. The outreach a lot of times looks like All Day Darling. We've been a beneficiary for raising funds, you know, a few months now, and looking to partner with other folks in that neighborhood. So outreach looks like that. It also looks like, as Anna was saying, partnering with other nonprofits who have aligned missions and kind of want to see this growth of community in general, and really just trying to expand our footprint via other nonprofits and businesses within Asheville, and obviously the community, the local folks that move here that make this city what it is.
Wow, you really do have a lot going on.
It's a whole thing.
Well, the thing is that strikes me is housing is just one piece of what almost sounds like a larger issue with community building. And mm-hmm. that's what you're doing mm-hmm. with your outreach, is it's building that community. So how can people think about this? People in Asheville, I think elsewhere, are aware of this problem of unaffordability and may not realize that we're all part of that problem in some way. We just don't really think about it. And so how can people, if they were to end the show today or stop listening – and they could give money, how could they plug into the community and actually be a part of it, integrate into it, and make a part and become part of the fabric of these communities?
Yeah, so Crystal mentioned volunteer opportunities, and that is one of the ways that people can get involved. We have many committees within ABCLT, and so people can serve on one of our committees. We also have what I call unpaid staff, which are individuals in the communities that are volunteering with us and provide a lot of expertise and a lot of time. You know, I'm talking like 5 hours a week, 10 hours a week sometimes to support the work that we do. So there are opportunities like that where people can really get involved with the work that we do. And, you know, if somebody can't give that much time, that we have other opportunities. We have events in the community. People can come to those events. People can come to larger community events that we support and, you know, table at those events. So contact us. There are lots of opportunities. I will also kind of go back to something that Crystal mentioned as far as the monthly donations. You know, one of the things that we didn't get to talk to today about today is Airbnbs. And what we're fortunate to have is several Airbnb owners who are donating proceeds from those Airbnbs to us. So some of those individuals are actually contributing monthly. And that is something that people can do. Again, if you're not able to contribute $500 at a time or $10,000 at a time, you know, set up a recurring donation to us, a monthly recurring donation. So it doesn't feel like such a large amount, but again, it's something that is going to be continuous and is going to create that community.
Are there sources of funds beyond grants for you? You mentioned Asheville. Are there other sources of large funds to help you buy homes?
No, we're primarily funded through grants. Again, the City of Asheville grant has been the biggest. So government is a huge supporter. There are many other community land trusts across the country where, you know, they're primarily funded by government sources. So lots of different examples. But outside of that, yeah, we rely on grants and we rely on individual donations and corporate donations.
What sorts of societal things need to change to really get to where we need to be in terms of affordable housing? And you said it's almost like a values thing. We put so much emphasis on money. But what else, what other kinds of things does society need to change?
Well, I think one of the things that applies to us is this concept of doing as much as we can as quickly as we can, right? We're not that organization that can build 100 units in a year. And so for us, we just want to ask people to get on board with the slower pace and have faith in the fact that that is going to create something permanent in the long term, right? That's really one of the things that we ask people to advocate for us, because we are different than other nonprofits, for-profits, government entities that create affordable housing. As far as, you know, the real estate market, we have to shift from thinking about profit and profit only. And I think that's the big shift that we have to make as a society. Because this is where we're creating community wealth building opportunities, not just individual wealth building opportunities. You know, again, our buyers do build individual wealth, but the main focus is community wealth building. We want to create opportunities for everyone to thrive in the communities. And so we have to stop thinking so much about individual profits and what I can make off the sale of my home and how I can benefit and how my kids can benefit. And we have to start thinking about how we all can benefit as a community, as a city, as a society.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to end, and for something for folks to think about is we've seen the results of extensive profit seeking in the United States. And I am all for the money making effort, but when it marginalizes people and pushes them out, I think we need to think again. And I think that's where we are. And so I think that that's what your organization is doing. I just really appreciate you coming in. Is, you know, it's just time to rethink how we live with wealth and how we need to shift from really oppressing people and having them be losers while other people win. It's not the way that, it's not why this country was founded. It's not the way capitalism should work. But anyway, something for all of us to think about. Thank you very much. It was great having you guys. Have a great day, everybody.